Public speaking. Most Americans dread the thought. It's a phobia that can silence important ideas and limit one's opportunities. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my guests from Toastmasters International share their journey to become confident speakers and encourage others to let their voices be heard. And we'll hear some examples of public speaking as a local Toastmaster uses her skill of storytelling to keep the attention of an audience, either in person or now virtually. So it's time to speak up and face that fear of public speaking and let your voice be heard. I'm David James, and 2 Main Street is next. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Given the choice, would you rather have a cavity filled or speak in public? Fear of public speaking, well, there's actually a word for it, glossophobia. Some statistics say it affects 75% of the population. That's 3 out of 4 people. Glossophobia ranks number one among our fears, ahead of death, illness, insects, heights, and even flying. Why do so many of us dread the thought of standing before a room of people with everyone looking at you and then starting to speak? What if panic sets in? You can't run? And what if there's a murmur in the crowd? Is anyone really listening? Are folks disappointed? Making fun of me? How can you conquer this fear and enjoy the moment? My guests are two members of the local Toastmasters Club, Sharon Combs and Chaz Patrick. The club helps calm those fears and nurture future public speakers. Now, before we get some tips on becoming a better public speaker, let's learn more about my guests. Let's start with you, Chaz. Tell us about yourself.
David, thank you for having us. I actually started Toastmasters about 4 years ago, and I had initially seen a Toastmasters flyer at one of our local employment offices, and I was thinking, man, this would really be something fantastic to be a part of. I attended my first meeting, and I had to do an icebreaker, which is one of the speeches you complete as a Toastmaster. And I remember sitting there like, I have to talk about myself for 4 to 6 minutes? There were a couple ahs, so's,
sure.
Some awkward silences. And that was really the trying moment for me as I realized that in any setting, we're all required to speak. And thus, I started my journey back then, and since I've been a part of the organization, I've served in different leadership roles and definitely have grown as a communicator.
So, Chaz, are you a native of Evansville?
I'm actually from Chicago originally. I have some backings there and did some time in the Marine Corps and went to school at Illinois State University and moved here and went to USI and made some great things happen during my time here.
So what's your occupation?
I am currently in the health services industry. Previous to that, I was in management. There are a lot of different transferable skills I was able to pick up through Toastmasters that helped in those capacities.
Sharon Combs, you're up next. Tell us about yourself.
Well, unlike Chaz, I've been speaking in public for a while because I'm 5'12". I can't hide behind people, and I often get picked on no matter how far I try to duck down in the seat. What Toastmasters has done for me is make me a better speaker. You won't notice it now, but I'm a stutterer. And when I get nervous, I stutter or I babble. I do one or the other. I stutter or I babble. So Toastmaster has taught me to speak coherently. And you don't notice the stutter unless this interview starts to go south and you hear it. And hopefully you won't hear the babble.
Where'd you grow up?
That's an interesting question.
Good.
I was born in Oklahoma. We moved to New York, Buffalo, New York. And then from there, we moved to Baltimore, Maryland, and from Baltimore, Maryland to Houston, Texas. So school was in Buffalo, New York, where I learned what it's like to be an Eskimo. I don't like it.
Well, yes, Buffalo is rather chilly up there, but it's near Niagara Falls. There you go.
Yes. And Niagara Falls is very warm and comforting in the summer,
sure.
Which is about 2 days. And then it's just a cold shower.
Definitely.
Because the water from the mist just sprinkles all over you, even with the raincoat. Mm-hmm. And it's cold.
So what is your occupation?
I am happily retired.
What did you do before you retired?
I was a problem resolution specialist, which is a very fancy title, but I'm also certified as an Apple genius. But that's only by Apple. Don't ask my family.
So what did you resolve? What differences? What did you handle? What cases?
Oh, I work for AT&T, so it's more technical. It's basically about your phone or some type of your internet that's not working correctly. Mm-hmm. Then I'm the person that you call, and I'm going to say, turn it off, turn it back on, and let's see if it works.
Did you have to have a lot of patience with that job?
Yes, you do. Mm-hmm. Yes, you do, because some things are obvious, but you can't say things like that. So you have to walk people through it. And some of it is not. That's why with AT&T, I had to be certified. Mm-hmm. A lot of things I do, I had to be certified. And we're not going to actually mention my full age, but I have over 27 degrees. And I have those because I found out that your job will pay you to get smarter. Mm-hmm. So I took advantage of that through my whole career. And that's how I got certified by Apple as a genius, but I also have certificates from AT&T. I'm also certified as a, I can splice lines.
Well, my goodness.
Yeah, not climbing a pole. I'm just certified.
All right. We're learning a lot about Chaz Patrick and Sharon Combs, members of the Toastmasters Club here in Evansville. And I did some research. The Toastmasters journey actually began in 1905 with a gentleman named Ralph Schmedley, who was working with the YMCA in Bloomington, Illinois. He saw a need back then for men in the community to learn how to speak, conduct meetings, and plan programs and work in the community. Of course, we still have that need today. But it used to be a male-only group. Now, obviously, females are welcome. But that didn't happen until 1973, Chaz. Does that surprise you?
You have to really grow with what's going on in society. I think with a lot of the changes that the organization took a collective front to say, hey, we need to be integrated and show that diversity in regards to our growth.
That still kind of amazes me that women weren't invited in the club until 1973. Sharon, does that surprise you?
No, because I was there in 1973, and there are a lot of things women weren't allowed to do. So that's just one of them. Mm-hmm.
There's still a kind of a glass ceiling, I know, but,
yes.
But they're trying to crack that every day.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you go to a Toastmasters Club meeting, who are the members, and what happens at a meeting? Chaz?
David, that's a good question. Every Toastmasters meeting that you attend has a similar, how can I say it, model. There's usually the Toastmaster who is responsible as more of the MC, and with that, they actually introduce the prepared speakers. The speakers usually have a targeted project that they're working on and then transforms into our table topics, which is where we practice impromptu speaking 1 to 2 minutes, and then it follows into our evaluation portion. The speakers actually get that evaluation from members, which helps them in their development.
So who are people that attend this meeting? Are they young professionals or are people from all walks of life?
All walks of life. I've been in, during my time with Toastmasters, I've been in a few different types of clubs because they're international. And I can tell you that every club's different in regards to the interactions, the relationships, but we're all there in order to produce a better version of ourselves. And that's the collective effort when we meet every day or every time.
Now, a person who goes to a club for the first time, are they intimidated, do you think?
Everybody is. They're thinking, are they going to ask me to speak? Do they want me to say something? And they're sitting there thinking, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. But that's why they're there. That's why they're there. And it is intimidating because when somebody gets up and speak, you don't realize the rehearsal they put into it, the time they put into it, the effort they put into it. You just see them stand up there saying, I don't think I can do that. And it is frightening. It's just the same with your job. If someone was to come in off the street and see how you do this and they think, okay, I can't sit behind that mic and do what he does because you do it smoothly. But they don't realize the time and effort that you put into it. And that's what it takes. It takes time and effort.
Well, I think preparation is very important. You just don't go up in front of a crowd and not know your topic.
No, and Toastmasters is the perfect venue for that.
Because they will call you out on it, right? The members.
They would definitely give you some words of...
encouragement?
Positive feedback.
Positive feedback, yes. That's what we call it. Or coaching. Because obviously in our lives, we deserve to have that constructive feedback to grow.
Now, of course, confidence is what you need to be a good public speaker. I believe that would be important. And this fear that most Americans have of standing up in front of a group, glossophobia, I think, is the term that's used for that. Did you guys have that dread at one time?
That's my biggest dread, even now.
Really?
Because I don't want to appear foolish. Even though I said I have multiple degrees, that doesn't mean anything if I stand in front of a crowd and then I babble. So I don't want to appear foolish. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking through the crowd, I'm looking at everybody, and I'm thinking, are they getting what I'm saying? And that's important. Nobody wants to look like a clown.
It's probably good to have a little bit of the butterflies before you speak to a group.
Definitely, because you're able to really channel into that and picture the best version of yourself in regards to the presentation and use that to your advantage in regards to getting your message across effectively.
Do you remember the first time you had to speak in front of a group, Chaz?
I remember the first time I had to sing in front of a group. Does that count?
Well, sure.
I actually was in musical theater in high school, and there were a few productions that I was a part of. I remember singing Edelweiss with a beautiful acoustic guitar. Uh-huh. And the other, you know, I was involved in sports and in musical bands, so it really kind of, every performance you have to practice, right? And use, really go through those feelings and sort through them in order to maximize your outcomes, at, right?
Sharon, did you start speaking in front of groups at an early age?
I would say yes, but for a different reason, because I was bullied. So I figured out what was going on, the psychology. I just figured out what the bully was doing. So they picked on me because of things I couldn't help, but they made jokes and it was funny and everybody laughed. So I said, okay, let's flip the script. So the next time the bully came up, I stood in front of the classroom. I made the jokes about myself. Everybody still laughed. Then I made a few about the person who's bullying me. Everybody laughed. And now I said, so this is how this works. And then I became, I'm not saying the class clown, but I became the person that took the center. And I did that because I found out quickly they don't care who's standing up there as long as you make a laugh. Mm-hmm. Now, my first public was a poetry reading. I wrote a book of poems, and I didn't know how to do anything about it. So I went to a club, and I said, you have a second floor you're not using. Can I use that to do a poetry reading? And he said, sure, because he didn't care. He wasn't using it. And it went over well. And then he came back and said I couldn't do it anymore because when people are reading poetry, they're not buying, I mean, listening to poetry, they're not buying drinks. They're not dancing. And I was filling his room, but I was emptying the downstairs where he was making the money. That was short-lived.
Well, coming up, more of my conversation with our Toastmasters here. We'll share some tips on public speaking, some important do's and don'ts, and what's a good opening line, and the importance of knowing the crowd you're speaking to. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. The history of public speaking can be traced back to ancient Greece, where men were required to give speeches in the marketplace as part of their civic duty. They would debate politics, economics, and whether to go to war. Aristotle stressed three strategies to persuade people: ethos, logos, and pathos. Ethos, meaning the speaker has credibility and knowledge of the subject. Logos, using facts to support the argument. And pathos, the emotional appeal to gain the acceptance of the audience. Ethos, logos, and pathos. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. And if public speaking is your number one fear ahead of disease, illness, even death, you are not alone. Most Americans are terrified of the thought of speaking before a crowd, even a small group of people. a fear known as glossophobia. Toastmasters International tackles those fears and builds confidence through regular meetings where speakers are encouraged and critiqued. My guests are Chase Patrick and Sharon Combs with the Evansville Toastmasters. Now, before we get to some of the do's and don'ts and those awkward pauses, let's talk about equipment. I can't remember how many times I've had to speak to a group and something went wrong with the microphone or the speaker. So it's important that the equipment works, right, guys?
Yes, David, it does. I mean, I've actually had some encounters where I'm like, can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Oh, I know.
And then, yeah, obviously, depending on the venue, you usually can play it off just speaking with your voice.
Have you ever had those problems?
Actually, the last speech I gave, it wasn't the mic. The air conditioner came on. And it was louder than me, but I didn't know that because I was still speaking, but I wasn't aware that they couldn't hear everything I was saying. Because on the stage, I could hear me.
Sure.
But out in front, they couldn't. And I didn't know till later. You know, they said, well, next time that happens, speak up because we can't. Well, I didn't know you could hear me. I didn't because I could hear me. So,
live performances. I mean, you never know what's going to happen.
I will know we also have had a band play while we're speaking as well. That adds a different type of element in regards to being able to think on the fly as far as how you're going to respond.
How did that happen?
Well, we actually meet in the church, and the church rehearses the same night that we're meeting. But because of COVID, they're not doing it right now.
Sure.
And we can just remember just hearing the music and just a slight pause. And after it finishes, you're like, all right, let's continue on. Something definitely to get adjusted to in regards to venue dynamics.
Yeah, I always like when people say, we can't hear you. You know, you hear that from the back of the crowd. And then you go, well, I don't know if that should have raised it. Just the microphone or just a shout. I don't know what to do sometimes. But these things just happen, and you got to go with it on the fly. What are some of the groups that you've spoken to, Sharon? I mean, I'm obviously many. Any group that really had you kind of intimidated?
No.
Really? Good.
No. I have just a sense of confidence about myself that I believe I'm better than a lot of people think I am. So,
well, you have to have that, I guess.
I do. I really do, because I've been in front of people. I've been where I was the only person in the room that looked like me. I sat at the end of a long mahogany table where there were no other females or no other minorities, and I had to sit there and talk to them like I knew what I was talking. I don't have room to doubt myself, because if I doubt me, you doubt me. So I have an unusual sense of self-confidence. Now, when I get away, I might get the nerves again, but I can't let you see me cry. Mm-hmm. Even if I feel like it, even if I feel a tear behind that eye, I am going to look at you and I am not going to blink, because that's just my nature.
Well, obviously, public speaking now in the era of COVID-19 is a lot different. There are Zoom meetings now, and I just attended one this week. With Dr. Rashawn, University of Southern Indiana President Ron Rashawn, who's a great speaker.
Yes, he is.
And he handled this thing very well, the Zoom meeting. But that's really a challenge, though, because they're in different locations. There's a little pause in between the interaction. So any tips for a good Zoom meeting, guys?
I Zoomed yesterday with Alberta, Canada. I Zoom on Saturdays with London and on Sundays with Taiwan, because I love Zoom. I talk to people all over the world. If they're new Zoomers, it's always good to start the meeting out with what your requirements are so that everybody knows and you're on the same page. And that's just for your Zooming. Sometimes you're in a meeting and you get this.
Dead air.
That's what you get. But the screen froze.
Oh.
And you thinking they're pausing or thinking, and then after a while you saying, no, they're not. They're either bad Wi-Fi or the connection's broke. And you're in the middle of something or speech or evaluation, so Zoom adds a new level to it. But the first thing you said, just like Zoom etiquette, you have to make the rules known. There are some people who don't want to be recorded for their reasons. And you have to ask in the beginning of the meeting, if you don't want to be recorded, let us know. And there are reasons they don't, and you don't question that. But you want to make these rules known. if you don't want to speak up or if you just want to attend the meeting, you have to say, these are my clubs, these are my rules, so everybody will feel comfortable being there. You want to get halfway through and say, we're going to need everybody to turn the cameras on so we know who we're talking to. If you make this known in the beginning and somebody's not comfortable with that, then that's their choice. But just like any meeting, you make your rules known at the beginning of the meeting.
So how effective are these Zoom meetings, do you believe?
It really enhances a totally different skill set. I mean, between configuring audio, making sure your video's good, making sure positioning is good because sure. You don't want to have a camera too low or too high. I definitely think it really expounds on a whole different area of presenting. I know this year with Toastmasters and COVID going on, we're actually doing a lot of our competitions virtually. And so we really have to think outside of the box in regards to making sure that we're using the space that we have in this little cube on the string to make sure our audience gets the picture in regards to our message.
And of course, when you're speaking publicly, you want to get the reaction of the audience. And you have a very small audience on a Zoom meeting. And is that difficult to get that excitement going, do you think, Sharon?
No, I've had Zoom meetings with 30 and 40 people, and they're really small on the screen. Or you have to flip the screen to see them. Mm-hmm. What you have to remember about Zoom is not their part, but your part. A lot of times during a Zoom meeting, you're looking at the screen, not the camera. Your gestures are lost, because if you're gesturing as you normally gesture, they're going to be below camera view, and that might be part of the speech of what you're trying to portray. That gets lost. Not so much the audience, but how you present yourself to the audience. That changes greatly with Zoom. You can fade into your background. I held up a sign. I have a background. I held up the sign. I forgot it was on green paper. And it was in the middle. I couldn't change it. Mm-hmm. And it was part of the prop I was using. So it's just different things you have to take. But I had a Zoom meeting with 4 people, and I had a Zoom meeting with 30 or 40 people. So it's not really the audience, because I can see their reaction. I do remind audiences when I'm talking to them, this is afterwards, because I'm an area director, so I visit different clubs. And I'll say, just so you know, that while you're on camera, you're on camera. I know you're all looking at me, but realize everybody's looking at you. So if you're bored or mad or angry, everybody sees that. And if you're not paying attention and you're just wandered off or chewing something, Zoom has an option where you can take the picture off and put up that. You can put up your glossy and take you off the screen while you do those. But I have to tell people during meetings, don't put your bad face forward. Keep your best foot forward, your best face. And if you can't do that for whatever reason, put up your glossy, take a step away.
The other aspect of it is make sure you don't have any pets or kids, because they will bust in your meeting.
Sure.
And totally cause you to lose train of thought. I've learned that firsthand myself, and of course.
My daughter's a high school teacher, and she's had to do these virtual lessons with her students at home. And she tells some stories, but, you know, they'll be in their pajamas, or they'll be eating popcorn, or playing on their phone, you know, and other people are watching them, too. And she has to remind them, listen, we're all on camera here, you know, and you got to pay attention. So she has to keep reminding them about that. So, yeah, she's telling some stories about what they're doing and are not doing. It's pretty frightening at times.
I will say bless our teachers, because they have an important job to do.
Oh, it's another burden they have to carry. Yes. Doing these virtual meetings. Now, we're talking about gestures. How important are gestures during a speech?
Just as if you are referring to online or in person.
Let's say in person.
In person, commanding the presence, and that's more my preference, but, you know, standing tall, having your shoulders kind of brought back, and really using your hands strategically in order to make certain points, that usually helps from what I've gained in regards to presenting.
Of course, you don't want to overdo it either.
No.
Because that's distracting.
Yes.
Definitely. Obviously, that opening statement is very important to set the tone for the meeting. So how do you go about starting a speech?
You need a hook.
Okay.
You want that first word, that first sentence to grab them and pull them in. And you make them want to think about it. Hook for one of my speeches was, I'd like everyone to raise their hand if you had a job that required you to be punched in the face.
You get everybody's attention.
And surprisingly, one person raised their hand. It wasn't just me. I was a Baltimore County police officer, and we had to take self-defense, so that's why my job required me to be able to give blows, take blows. But that was my hook. How many of you have had a job that required you to be punched in the face?
Were you ever punched in the face?
Yeah. You had a mask and everything.
Mm-hmm. But you were punched.
Well, just so you know, those little bitty lights that you see in the commercial, the cartoons, the little birds that fly around?
Yes.
Those lights are real. You see white little snaps of light all around your head. And I'm pretty sure that's shaken baby syndrome, except it's an adult. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I was punched in the face, and I didn't like it, and I try to avoid things like that.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. What about a good opening line for you, Chaz?
I would just say quotes. Quotes are questions. And with stories, you can usually set some type of setting. I will say that one of my recent speeches, I used the time that I found out that my grandmother had passed. And that was naturally able to really draw the audience into what I was going to tie the major lesson into. And was really effective. I think with powerful stories like that, people are naturally, you know, cultivated into listening even more rather than it be informational. And, you know, I really accomplished what I needed to do in regards to that speech, which was reflect my grandmother's legacy.
Well, those first few moments of any speech are so important because you can pretty well know how the rest of it's going to go.
Yes.
If there's no real reaction, then you have to really fight it. I'm sure, I know I've had that before too, speaking to some groups, and I can see them kind of, you know, shuffling and nodding, and they're not interested at all in that. So how do you get them back once you lose them? Is it a battle?
I'm a storyteller, and my life is interesting enough that I can throw little breadcrumbs out there that'll bring them back. It's just like that. Just like when you have the hook, then you have to have the middle, and then at the end, you got to bring it back to where you started.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have the hook and then you don't have the rest of the ingredients, mm-hmm. you're not going to get a cake. You're not going to get what you're baking. You have to have something meaty in between. So if I say, I rode three states on a motorcycle crying. I rode through three states crying. Can you just imagine that? Well,
you want to know more. Why is she crying?
But that's a good hook. But what if I drop it in the middle? And then I have to bring it back to how I got out of that situation, which is the end. So if you're looking at your audience and you're dropping it in the middle, you didn't have enough ingredients in that cake. You didn't. It's gotta be filling.
So it's a story, a beginning, a middle, and an end.
I'm a storyteller, so mm-hmm. that's mine. You can't throw anything out there. You can say, well, I rode through three states crying, then I drank about four bottles of water and I was okay. Thank you.
Sometimes you could throw humor in there too, in order to try to draw people even in. I know Sharonda has this spectacular talent of being very humorous, and I always look forward to when she speaks, but she's also able to really convey a serious tone when she speaks. I know I've actually witnessed her compete in some of our contests, which she does great at.
If people sometimes are tense when they go to these meetings and everything, am I going to be bored or here? Like, is this going to last for 20 minutes? They're looking at their watch and stuff. So if you can get them having some enjoyment, I mean, you got them right there.
Very important ingredient. Okay.
But everything is not funny. So if you have a serious conversation you have to have with them,
mm-hmm.
you still have to have your hook. Mm-hmm. You still have to have your ingredients, and you still have to wrap it up in the end. Mm-hmm. I'm a storyteller, and I'm weird. So even my stories that are not funny will still touch your heart, and they'll reach you, and they'll pull you in.
And maybe have some comic relief in the middle there to kind of break some of that.
Some of the things I think are funny are not funny.
Okay.
My children told me before I came on here today the things I'm not allowed to say because, Mom, that's not really funny.
But it's funny to you, right?
Yeah, just to me, though.
Okay. My guests are Sharon Combs and Chaz Patrick with the Evansville Toastmasters International. Coming up, more about what makes a successful public speaker and the joy of public speaking. Wow. And putting others at ease. And that must be a great feeling when you accomplish something like that. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. And if you're just joining us, my guests are Chaz Patrick and Sharon Combs with the Toastmasters Club of Evansville. We are toasting their efforts to encourage more folks to participate and enjoy public speaking. Instead of sitting in silence, stand up with confidence and let your voice be heard. The Toastmasters are involved in community projects, including speech competitions and a Pathways to Education project. Tell us about that, guys.
David, I think it's interesting in regards to where we're at in the world. Previously to the Pathways Learning Experience, which is the new program, much of the curriculum was in manuals. And in these manuals, you had 5 projects or speeches that you had to complete. One, I actually remember it was a roast, and I had to roast somebody. And at the time, our club president, he's a very interesting character. So I handcuffed him, gave him some lumps of coal for Christmas, and after I finished it, and it was within time, I was able to complete the project. With Pathways Learning Experience, it's very diverse. And it's all web-based in regards to attaining the content. And there are different types of projects. There's creating a podcast project. There's speaking entertainment. There's the humorous speaking project as well. There's 11 different paths, all designed essentially to be more individual-focused. So rather, if you want to become better at planning, there's an innovative planning path. If you want to be better with really enhancing your message and be able to talk to people all around the world or what have you, there's the visionary communication path. So all these paths are very specialized as far as what you want to acquire, complete professionally or personally.
What about these speech competitions? Do you involve high school students?
You have to be 18 years and over to be part of Toastmasters. But there are programs that Toastmasters can sponsor with high school students. It's a little bit different, but for Toastmasters, it's 18 and over.
She's referring to the youth leadership program. We have that, and that's the best practices. We usually facilitate that to 4-H groups, high school students. The sky's the limit in regards to making sure that the next generation has the tools they need to be successful.
Now, who are some public speakers that maybe you might emulate or appreciate or celebrate? Besides Sharon.
You can answer.
Well, I actually like Les Brown. Les Brown's a pretty riveting speaker. He really speaks to people in regards to their life journeys.
And tell me about him. Where's he from?
Les Brown, I believe, is from, I think, in Baltimore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually found out about him a few years ago, and he really has some captivating messages. He's had some downs, and he's had some ups, and he's become really successful in being able to help people bring out the better version of themselves. And so, I follow him from time to time.
Who do you like to listen to?
Oh, you know it has to be Michelle.
Oh,
oh, yeah, because
Michelle Obama.
Yeah, because she's calm no matter what. You know, she doesn't get riled. She doesn't get upset. She's very intelligent. You can't throw anything at her. For instance, if somebody comes back with anger or something like that, she just handles it, and she handles it with intelligence, and she handles it with grace. I would like to be that way and not like everything everybody said affect me. And sometimes in the back of my head, I'm thinking, you know, what you said wasn't really the right way for you to say that. Then I have to get my Michelle on.
I'm going to throw this one out. Donald Trump is a public speaker. Let's just see what happens here.
He is, because he speaks in public.
Well, and he, I think he speaks to his crowd. I think he does that.
I have a funny story about him. Actually, I did an internship with the American Legion out in D.C., and we were actually doing the Boys Nation and Girls Nation program, and everybody was actually on the trip to the White House, and we were sitting on the East Wing, and it was a very hot day. I mean, sun's beating down, everybody's in suits. It was hot. He actually, which they didn't actually record, he actually came out before his actual official presentation, and I can remember there being a teleprompter in the back, and he did a fantastic job in regards to making sure he followed the teleprompter. But within that, I mean, he had that natural energy, I guess, really to get the crowd going, and the kids were, excited to see him and really enjoy that day. But it was definitely something that I've actually seen in person, and he is really good with deflecting in regards to certain questions as well.
Oh, yeah. He's a master at that. He really is. Yeah. I went to the White House one time when Ronald Reagan was president, and he spoke to us at a luncheon. And just very folksy. And, you're in the presence of the President of the United States, and you're in this beautiful room with all these portraits and everything, and you're intimidated by it. Welcome, welcome to your house. This is the White House, and just made everybody feel at home, and just a very folksy guy, and I thought he really did a good job of making everybody feel at ease, and I think that's very important.
You know who else is good? George W. Bush. He is really good in regards to making you feel comfortable when he speaks. I actually seen him speak in person at the, he has an institute out in Texas. We were invited there for a leadership institute, and he was very just kind of, layman's terms, nothing too complicated, nothing too technical, and he made everybody feel like they were at home.
So what are some of the traits of a successful public speaker? What do you think?
They have to hold your attention. That's very important. They have to reach their audience, touch their audience. And sometimes if you have a diverse audience, that might be difficult. But you have to find something in common, that we all have in common, and you have to do that. I have a diverse group of friends, and I talk to them and relate to them on the things we have in common, not the things we disagree on. So you have to find that in the audience, because it's difficult. If you have an audience that's that diverse, you can't come out on one subject and speak on one subject, because you're going to miss the other part of the audience. So find something that everybody has in common. There's something we all care about.
Really do. Now, scanning the audience, looking for signs of approval or disapproval, that's something I still have trouble with. When I was a TV anchor, I talked to thousands of viewers every night, but I didn't really see them. I looked into a camera and assumed the viewers were paying attention. So it's much different facing folks and making that eye contact. Again, now it's quite a challenge with all these Zoom meetings. Now, during these club meetings, what are some frequently asked questions from the new members? What do they want to know? What tips do they want to know to become a better speaker?
They want to know, am I going to have to talk in front of everybody? How long is it going to take me to be as good as you?
Okay.
They want to know, what is this program that I have to learn? And is it going to be difficult? Because they lose interest. You already have a job. You don't want another job just trying to learn how to speak. You have to let them know how important it is to them to commit yourself to the program. Because you're walking in this room the first time you go to Toastmaster. When I first joined up with Toastmaster, an elderly guy told me, and I don't remember his name, but he just told me after I stuttered something through a meeting, you need Toastmasters. You need Toastmaster. Your information is good, but you're making a fool of yourself. You need Toastmasters. I had to commit myself to it to get something out of it. People will come into a Toastmasters meeting, and they're going to say, I'm not going to be that good, or this is too hard, or I'll come back later, you know. And if you don't hook them then, chances are they may not come back later.
So what's been the feedback from folks, from Toastmasters, who maybe came in intimidated and timid, and then several months or a year later, they're confident?
Well, I think a large part of that ties into mentorship, too. And one of the great things about what's going on now with the Toastmasters and our education program is that everyone has the opportunity to mentor. And with mentoring, you know, outlining those short-term, long-term goals and then the action plan, it really helps in regards to having those check-ins with new members and really kind of getting them to see the long-term vision that they need to achieve while they're a member.
So you guys get a high when you speak to a group? Is there a high that you get from that, or does it come afterward?
I always enjoy myself because I have fun by myself. Well, that sounds weird on the radio. No, but I scan the crowd. You can't stand in one spot and talk to one person. You got to scan the crowd. And when you see the person that's not interested, you want to bring them in. You want to draw that person in. And you want to talk to them, make them that special person.
So that's your challenge when you see somebody that's not really on board.
Yeah. I want to find you. I want to talk to you. I want to ask. And if I ask questions, they think I'm talking directly to them, and they have an answer. So even if I don't get the answer from them at the end of the speech, they're going to say, you know, that happened to me. Let me tell you this. And they want to share their story. So I look for someone in the audience. If it's just three or four people, I'm going to talk to those three or four people. But I will search out the person who's playing on their phone, and I'm going to talk to them directly. And I'm going to challenge them or ask them a question. And it's like how your teacher wants to make sure you've been paying attention. I'm going to ask them a question. And they'll be ready to answer, but I'm going to carry on. So at the end of the meeting, they're going to come back to me with, you know, that happened to me. Let me tell you.
Mm-hmm. Well, guys, this has been a lot of fun. I want to leave our listeners maybe with a favorite toast of yours, an opening or closing line. So take it away, Chaz.
Dave, I think this is very relevant to what's going on in today's society. As Toastmasters, we usually get like a leader letter in regards to, you know, things that our leadership is telling us. And one of the things I found from a recent article was related to the COVID situation. And I'm going to cite our Toastmasters International President, Richard Beck. He noted that all challenges contain opportunities. We will all face challenges, but it's how we look at them that allows us to find the opportunities within them. With the phobia of public speaking, Toastmasters is able to help and really channel the greater version of yourself and really create that challenge into an opportunity for you to have a better version of yourself and a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. Because we're all communicators in one area or another.
Mm-hmm. Chaz Patrick, thank you so much. Sharon Combs, what are some of your favorite toasts or opening and closing lines?
I think mine is, I won't back down. I won't back down. I will march with you to the gates of hell, but I won't back down. And that's just the way it has to be. If I'm tackling a speech or a problem, or if I'm trying to get someone else to invest himself in the Toastmaster, I'm with you, and I'm going to hold your hand, and I'm not going to quit. I'm just going to drag you along with me, and we're going to get this done, because I won't back down. You got the right mentor, because I do mentor someone else. And if she gets afraid, you don't have to do anything until it's your time, but I'm going to tell you this. I won't back down. I've been through it. You can go through it. We are going to get through it.
I would hate to be a heckler in your in your crowd there. I think you would shut them down quickly.
I'm just going to bring them in and make them feel welcome.
Well, anyway, some great information about Toastmasters. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Thanks for listening. Sharon Combs is a noted storyteller, and she shares her talent with local and international Toastmaster groups. Here's Sharon Combs on a recent Zoom session. The exercise, share a story about a childhood memory. She starts with the tale of ants in her pants, and then peas in a pod.
And I was just a child sitting on the cinder block fence around the front of the house. I was just sitting there and doing things children do, digging in the dirt with a stick, watching the birds, watching the leaves, watching occasional traffic come by. And my mother was sitting on the porch and she yells down at me, "Watch out for the ants. Ants." And I looked around and over to the side, there was a line of ants marching toward me. And I looked at them for a minute, but I got bored and I stopped looking. And I finished digging in the dirt and watching the leaves and watching the traffic. And then, ow, 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 ow. There are ants all over me. Apparently, if you sit in the way of a line of ants, they march right through you. They do not march around you. I was covered with ants. I immediately started running in circles, fighting and screaming and hollering. My mother runs down from the porch and the chase is on. She's trying to catch a little child running away, trying to get away from ants. She grabs me and then she does something that shocks me even more. She starts tearing my clothes off. Now I'm really frightened because not only have the ants got me, but my mother has lost her mind. I don't know why she's tearing my clothes off. I'm outside. Get the ants off me. She's ripping my clothes off. She grabs me and she runs in the house where apparently she's already told my grandmother to fill the tub with water. Again, I didn't understand. They dumped me into the cold, cold water. Now I'm really fighting because not only did she strip me naked in public, she's trying to drown me. She's apparently forgotten all about the ants that are trying to kill me. She dumps me in the water and brings me out. She dumps me in the water and I'm fighting, I'm kicking, I'm scratching. This is not fun. I don't know why she's trying to kill me. Stop, stop, stop. That's all I'm yelling. Eventually, she's able to get all the ants off, drown them. I'm bug free. She picks me up. She wraps me in one of grandma's quilts. You know, the ones that always smell like mothballs that they keep in the cedar chest. And she sits in the rocking chair with me and she holds me and she tries to calm down her panicked little girl. And this is soothing and it's okay and I'm better. And she really wasn't trying to kill me. And then she says the things that my mother always says in times like this, just basic information. She looks me right in my face and it wasn't endearing. She said, "I told you to watch out for the ants." Peas in the pond started because I hate green peas. I want all of you to think about of the food, the one food that you really hate. And if you're right about it, you started hating it when you were a child. For whatever reason this food is, whatever food it is, you really hate it. Mine was green peas. I do not understand green peas. They're green, they're mushy, they have no flavor on their own. You have to drown them in butter, hide them in the mashed potatoes, put cream sauce on them. But if you just put a green pea on your spoon, it's mushy, it's nasty, I hate it. And I was like a spy when it came to green peas. I could hide them in the chair, in my pockets, lots of places, but I did not eat them unless I covered them in the mashed potatoes and pretend they weren't there. Well, in kindergarten, they served me green peas in school. I grabbed them up in my hand and I knew I had to get rid of these before I got back from the cafeteria to my classroom. So, walking past the goldfish pond, I dropped the peas in the pond. Fish must like green peas. They eat stuff like that, don't they? I didn't find out because my teacher caught me. And she was upset. And unfortunately for me, my aunt worked at that school. And she called my aunt and she told my aunt and stood there with my hand holding me and telling the aunt about me putting peas in the pool. And my aunt was highly embarrassed. But here's one thing. Communication is very, very important because What my aunt understood was, I peed in the pool. My aunt told my mother, marched me to my mother when my mother picked me up at school. She marched me to my mother and told my mother, I peed in the pool. I tried to explain it. And my mother called me by my whole name. And every child knows when your mother calls you by your first name, your middle name, and your last name, you are in big trouble. She called me by my whole name and said, did you pee in the pool? I said, no, ma'am. I put peas in the pool. That's what I said. So I tried to say it slower so she would understand. I said, I didn't pee in the pool. The teacher said you peed. Your auntie said you peed. Did you pee in the pool? No, ma'am. I put peas in the pool. That's what I said. This was going nowhere. So she marched me home, and she did what was traditional for them days. She gave me one smack on my bottom. She sent me to bed without any supper, not even nasty peas. And from then and to this day and forever, I hate green peas. It's not my fault. I learned to be a better communicator, but I still hate green peas. Madam Toastmaster.
Sharon Combs with the local Toastmasters. If you'd like more information on joining Toastmasters and to find a club near you, go to toastmasters.org. Two Main Street airs Thursday at 1 and Saturday at 11. And previous shows are on demand at wnin.org.